All right. My name is Megan Fullader.
My name is Adrian Pagic.
And I'm going to be interviewing Adrian today to talk about the Teaching Assistants Association and its role in the protests last year at the Capitol regarding Scott Walker's budget repair bill. And today is March 3rd, 2012. And I'll just move right into the questions.
Great.
So first I was hoping to ask you what it was that brought you to graduate school.
That's a very interesting question. I would say I had first thought upon graduating from my four-year institution that I might want to become an attorney as a way to effect social change. I had imagined myself to be, or had hoped myself to be, a female version of William Kunstler, actually, defending civil liberties and other things. And so I got a job at a law firm in New York City and quickly discovered that I didn't want to be that kind of person. So the next option was going to be graduate school. A belief that the way in which I would affect social change would be through education and the education of young people. Young people, of course, at a college age. But I believed, too, that in my last year of undergrad, where I had a really wonderful professor who provided me particular tools about the way in which to see and understand my world, I wanted to be able to share that too with other people. And so I think that was the impetus for applying to graduate school. But with also the understanding that it would be, I would like to be able to take what I learn and educate folks beyond just the standard college student. The notion that everybody, that lots of people, working people, could benefit from someone who was trained at a, basically the top program in the United States in the field of sociology. UW-Madison Department of Sociology is typically ranked in the top three, and it trades the number one position with Berkeley and the University of Michigan. So that was the reason I chose to come to Madison, was in part because it was, you know, the best program. And that the secondary reason was this mentor that I had in undergrad also had attended the UW-Madison and had the same advisor. So there was a connection there as well.
Nice. Who is your graduate mentor?
My undergrad or my my undergraduate mentor is Vivek Chibber at NYU, and my graduate advisor here at UW-Madison is Eric Wright.
Okay. Great. What are your primary research interests here at UW-Madison?
I would say right now, my current research interests are obviously within the realms of economic sociology and class. Economic sociology involves the study of work, labor, occupations. I'm also interested broadly in inequality and the ways in which those are connected to class as an economic material category, not as necessarily a cultural category or a broadly social category.
What drew you to those interests?
I think that what drew me to those interests? Well, I think growing up in a family with a single mother, I was painfully aware of the economic and social distance between our family and other families in my community. So I always was aware of that inequality. And as I became older, that inequality only became more stark, but not between my family and other families, more in my community overall. growing up also in a Catholic household and having a Catholic upbringing, I think made me sensitive to issues of social justice as something that I should be concerned with. And so I was always sensitive to those issues from a very, very young age. And so I think that in part that's where those interests come from. I also think, you know, seeing, having particular experiences as an old, you know, once I became an adult or when I was in college, it really influenced me. So seeing the graduate students at my undergrad institution, NYU, fight for a recognition of their union, and supporting my graduate student teaching assistant, I suppose, in my intro to women's studies class. That's when I first became aware of that struggle. And also, you know, living abroad, my junior year of college in Argentina and seeing the social unrest there in regards to economic inequality, participating or witnessing those protests, and the ways in which people struggle against oppression of all kinds. I think that probably informed some of my own personal politics or showed me the ways in which people can respond to those things.
Okay. When did you first become directly involved yourself in labor activism?
Well, I joined the union the day I came to UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. So when the union representatives visited our first day at the department, I signed my union card, my membership card, and became a member of the TAA then. It wasn't until the beginning of my second year that I became a sociology steward, a steward for the department. And that was after significant organizing from a friend and colleague within the department who had served as one of our stewards. I didn't know what exactly stewardship meant or what it, whether or not I would be an effective shop steward. And so I was very concerned about that. And it was after multiple conversations with this person who told me that I would be good at it and that they needed me to do it, that I willingly became the shop steward and was steward until this past year when I became the co-president of the Teaching Assistants Association.
Great. What type of assistantship, if you had one, did you have in spring 2011?
I was a project assistant at the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, also known as COWS, which is a think and do tank that's part of the Department of Sociology. We focus on a variety of issues from transportation policy to energy to workforce development and economic issues. To, you know, creating municipal level, state level, even national level policy suggestions for progressive office holders. And I was working specifically with Laura Dresser, who is the associate director, and working on workforce development and education training issues here in the state of Wisconsin.
Great. Is this a project assistantship that you still have?
I do still have it, and I've had it since I first matriculated at UW-Madison.
Great.
They were incredibly supportive of our participation in the protests. The entire office came and participated. Not only in the first march that we had on February 14th, but subsequent days afterwards, we would see all of our office mates, the research analysts, the associate director, Laura, the director, Joel, our office manager, other graduate students all in attendance and at the protests and the rallies in the days that followed.
Great, that's lovely.
Yeah, it was.
When the protests first began, were you involved from the beginning, or could you describe more of your involvement?
Yeah, I was involved from the very beginning. So as a precursor to what happened, I can tell you that that previous week, an article had appeared in the Isthmus, I believe written by a man with the last name Blaska or Blasco, if I'm correct. It's been a long time, but he had written an article that suggested exactly what the budget repair bill was before we had heard any official word on it. And I remember discussing it at a general membership meeting where we brought up the article, and we had been assured by our political education chair that that was, you know, impossible, that this guy was just, you know, he was like the right wing pundit for the Isthmus and was just, you know, I mean, essentially trying to get a rise out of people, and that there could be absolutely no truth to his article. And so that was that. And then later, I almost want to say later that week, but maybe it was, I actually can't remember the timeline, but I was sitting in a forum that was being held by PROFS, which is the professional representation of faculty, of the Faculty Senate. As it's an arm, it's the lobbying arm, essentially, of the Faculty Senate, which is one of the shared governance bodies on campus. And we were discussing the likelihood, it was basically a budget forum about what we thought the budget might look like. You know, because the governor clearly hadn't issued one, but we knew that that would be one of his tasks. And so we were thinking about the ways in which, and talking with not only legislators, Mark Pocan was there, for example, but also business persons and others about, you know, what they thought, how the budget might impact the UW, and how would the UW operate moving forward, and what would be the justifications for specific models and the like. And Mark Pocan, in the middle of that meeting, looked up from his smartphone and said, "I'm sorry, I have to stop what's happening right now. I have to tell you all that the governor is releasing, I've just gotten word that the governor is releasing something, you know, is going to release this piece of legislation, and you guys have to do something about it." And he literally said something along the lines of, you guys are going to have to do something, like, you'll have to do something big, a work stoppage or something. And this is our representative telling us this. And he was rather alarmed, and this information was trickling in. And the forum was filled with people who are faculty and staff and concerned graduate students like myself. And it was a small forum, but I remember looking over at another faculty who's a friend of mine in another department with worry. And after the forum had concluded, I went up to Mark Pocan to ask him if he had any further information. This was a Thursday. This was Thursday, February 9th. So he didn't, but I emailed in the midst of, after Mark Pocan made that statement, I remember texting or emailing from my smartphone our union staffers, as well as our political education chair and the co-presidents, to say, "I just heard Mark Pocan say X, you know, SOS, what's going to happen?" And so later that day, I went to dinner with a friend, but received a call at about 9 o'clock that night, that Thursday, from, I think, one of our staffers from Claiborne Hill, who said that we were having an emergency meeting at the office. Would you come? And so I went. And it was, I think there was a total of 7 of us there. And that includes staff. So I wasn't, again, I was just a steward. But the two co-presidents were there, our political education chair, myself, the membership secretary, Sigrid Peterson from geography, and then another steward from the sociology department, along with our staffers, where we, you know, tried to quickly hammer out as best we could what we were going to do, I guess, in response. And part of that evening's meeting was also about hearing what the bill said. So we had someone on the inside of the legislature who was reading the bill to us over the phone, while we tried to understand the implications of the measure. It had not been released yet. So, we had been given, you know, essentially the inside scoop. I imagine that various unions across the state had the same sort of phone calls that evening. So that's how it first began. I don't even remember the start of your question, so I apologize to go into that length of detail, but that's how it started. Mm-hmm. So, and for the next several days, you know, I mobilized or attempted to mobilize most of the folks in my department through a series of emails and Facebook messages. And I sent, you know, I sent my emails, as we oftentimes do, or at least some of us do within the union. When you as a steward draft an email to your department, particularly when you're trying to explain something that might be somewhat involved, it's always been my practice to send it onto the Stewards Council list so that other stewards can use it as a boilerplate message, so that, you know, they would need to tailor it to their own departments and not say dear sociologists, for example. But I'm sure I did that. And that following that weekend, so on Friday, that's when Governor Walker, I believe, announced the bill, or held a press conference. So I think that was the 11th, which means that Thursday was the 10th, not the 9th, as I said earlier. Mm-hmm. And that weekend we had a number of, we basically were at the office all weekend, where we began to make posters for what we were going to hold a protest, a march. And luckily, we also held phone banks and others to try and get the information out as quickly as possible to all of our members about what was going on, in case, and make member-to-member contact through the telephone rather than just through email. And so from that first meeting on Thursday night, where there were seven of us, it quickly grew to 40 to 60 on Saturday and 100 people at the office on Sunday. And it was actually rather, it was incredibly lucky, actually, because we had already had an event scheduled for February 14th, Valentine's Day, where before any of the budget repair bill stuff hit the fan, we had planned on holding the I Heart UW march and rally in order to remind the governor that we loved the UW and we were asking that he not break our hearts and instead make sure that he provided enough state support to keep the UW a strong Research One university. And so the union had created these, you know, quarter sheet Valentine's cards that said I Heart UW on the front and then had text on the back, and then provided space for folks to sign their names. And we had been collecting them all over campus, from faculty, from staff, from lots of students. And then we were going to deliver them to the governor, just like you deliver Valentine's at any time. So we amassed in front of Memorial Union on Monday the 14th, with red heart balloons and, you know, candy Valentine's Day hearts and that sort of thing. We encourage members to wear red. This is, again, an event where folks from my own office came. Folks who never leave the office, by the way, who have a heart, never leave the office, not even to go out to lunch, but left the office to participate in the march. And we had, you know, some, you know, posters or signs talking about, you know, supporting the UW. And we believe that there were over 1,000 people that inevitably marched from Memorial Union on campus to the state capitol steps. And then everyone marched inside the Capitol, and folks went up to the governor's office and delivered the Valentines. I remained outside because I was responsible for diverting the crowd once the Valentines had been delivered to the opposite side of the Capitol building, where the governor's office is actually located, on the King Street side of the Capitol. And so myself and William Scott in the history department remained outside and led the protesters to the other side, where we had a rally. And then folks dispersed. So that was the first day. And the second day, February 15th, Tuesday, was the day that the Joint Finance Committee began hearing public testimony on the budget repair bill. I can stop there or continue. I don't know. I want to make sure that I'm not getting off of your interview schedule. Sorry.
No. This is excellent. Okay. I do particularly for maybe the first week, yeah, in regard to the committee's hearings. I want to hear a little bit more about, yeah, perhaps what your involvement in these protests were, what involvement you observed as well.
Yeah. So the weekend, February 12th and 13th. We, the TAA held a number of phone banks and other activities like poster making to prepare for what the action that we would be taking on Tuesday when they began to hear testimony. We were going to protest outside the state capitol and rally, demonstrate our dislike of the budget repair bill. So that was our plan. We also sent out emails and encouraged people to bring along sleeping provisions, because we were encouraging all of our membership to come to the Capitol and give testimony. And because we weren't aware of how long the wait would be to give testimony on the bill, each person who provided testimony would be given 2 minutes to say their piece. We did not know exactly when folks would get up to the mic or would be able to speak to the Joint Finance Committee. So, you know, we advised people to bring sleeping bags just in case, you know, they'd be called at 1 a.m. So after a whole day of protesting outside in the cold, it was about that Tuesday at about 4 o'clock, the MTI teachers showed up, and that was great. I remember standing on the State Street side of the steps, outside, directing people inside to give testimony if they wanted. I had my own sign. I was kind of standing by the forward statue and, you know, screaming at the top of my lungs and welcoming the teachers there. There were folks at the United Council offices, which United Council represents students at the UW system, universities, colleges. They were also phone banking there to alert members, meaning students, of what was going on, and what impact the bill would have on their education, on their teachers, etc. And so the protests continued. There was, I'm sure there were rallies outside. There were speakers. I can't remember who spoke at what rally, but after Tuesday, there were rallies every day. and the protests just got larger. On Tuesday night, myself and Lenora Hansen, I would say we were three people away from the desk at the Joint Finance Committee room where we were going to provide testimony. This was about 9 o'clock at night. And so we were like the third and fourth people there. And when we got to the desk to fill out our slips, the person, the aide manning the desk, who was taking our information, you had to fill out this form to say if you were going to be testifying in favor or against the bill. He told us that we would not be allowed to speak. So we could register our anti-position, but we could not we would not be given the 2 minutes to testify before the Joint Finance Committee. And so upon hearing that, I believe we started to make a ruckus in the sense that it almost was like a telephone line where we told the person next to us and they told the person next to them that we would not be allowed to speak, that they were cutting off testimony, ending the hearing of testimony. And we all used, thankfully we had smartphones. We texted others in the building because people were downstairs on the rotunda on the first and second floors of the Capitol building watching the testimony. They had, I don't know who within the Capitol had erected or set up television sets, but you could actually watch the testimony being given, and you could also sit in overflow rooms and watch as people provided their own testimony. So our members were, and others from other unions, most likely teachers, concerned members of the public, were in other areas of the Capitol while we were on the fourth floor waiting to provide testimony as we stood in line to register. And we reached out to, you know, I called somebody I knew that worked at WKOW to try and get them, you know, we tried to reach out to the media to let them know that the Joint Finance Committee was not going to hear our testimony. And things just kind of grew from there. Apparently the ruckus we made with chants like "let us speak" got the attention of the Joint Finance Committee because Lena Taylor came out to talk to us. And there's a video of this, actually, a YouTube video that you can watch that a fellow TAA member, Shaheen Izadi, shot, where you can see this process actually unfold, where she told us that she was trying to negotiate with the other members of the committee to allow us to give testimony, but that we needed to be quiet, and, you know, she was on our side, and ended up turning out that, you know, in the end, they did not allow us to speak. Peter Barca, at the time, was apparently still in the building because he issued a letter in support of us, which I remember reading to everyone in the hall at the top of my lungs, so that people could hear that there were other members in the legislature who were in support of us. And we waited in that hallway for hours. I think it was after 1 o'clock in the morning, by the time the Joint Finance Committee ended. So there were hundreds of us in that hallway outside of the Joint Finance Committee hearing room, you know, waiting for word about whether or not we would be allowed to testify or not. And when we were finally told that we would not be, we all, because it was so late, and again, so many of us had already brought sleeping stuff, we went back down to the rotunda floor, where we prepared to bed down for the evening. And it was at that time, it might have actually been as early as 3 a.m, though again, I can't remember. Time stopped meaning anything. But that was when Bob Jauch held a he spoke to us with a microphone, along with Peter Barca and Lena Taylor and others, in support, encouraging us, encouraging us and saying that we had a right to provide testimony and that they were going to try and they would fight for us, and they thought that this was an illegitimate use of power, and that the Joint Finance Committee had overstepped its bounds, and so that they would as our representatives were interested in hearing, even if the Joint Finance Committee members weren't interested in hearing what we had to say about the budget repair bill, they were interested, and so would be holding hearings nonstop until people stopped, until there was no more testimony to be given. So from that moment forward, the Democratic Party representatives and senators in the legislature held nonstop hearings on the budget repair bill, and many of us in the TIA, we all took turns making sure that there were enough people to provide that testimony and to make sure that that testimony would keep going. And we all took turns sitting in whatever room the Democratic reps and senators were hearing testimony in, to listen to some really eloquent things said by high school students about their teachers, from, you know, retirees who had worked without protections of a union and what that was like for them, everyone's reflections on how this would make things so much harder, and that's what was going on inside. We also, I believe it was on Wednesday, February 16th, when the TIA was able to get its own room within the Capitol. We were given, I want to say it was 315 Northeast. It could have been 415 Northeast, but I think it was 315 Northeast, to use as an outpost of sorts to, again, have a foothold within the Capitol building itself. And again, things kind of mushroomed from there. I can't explain the ways in which how those tens of thousands of people came out, but I know that we were working inside that room within the Capitol, communicating to our members and I guess the outside world, if you will. Members were communicating with, by that time, you know, some national media outlets had seen what was going on in Wisconsin and had come, and so some of our members had actually sought out those media persons to, you know, talk to them about what was going on the inside and how all of this had come about. The protests, the marches continued outside. That was one of the best parts about the uprising, watching, protesting outside and seeing when 3,000 students from East High School had marched nearly 3 miles out of their school in support of their teachers. And that was all completely student organized and student run. And witnessing their arrival was really spectacular. Seeing young people understand what was at stake was incredibly moving. Seeing the firefighters and police who had been exempted within the budget repair bill, had not been threatened with the loss of their collective bargaining rights, effectively the loss of them anyway, also came out very much in support, as did other private sector unions. So when the Teamsters showed up, you know, it was incredibly heartening to see everybody come together in this really powerful way. And it continued like that for 3 weeks, at least.
Great. You had mentioned you couldn't remember precisely who was speaking at which rally throughout the course of this time period, but are there any speeches in particular that stand out for you or that you would like to comment on?
Sure. The one speech that I think was really, really phenomenal was Tony Schultz's speech. Tony Schultz is a farmer, a native of Wisconsin, and he spoke incredibly powerfully about the connection between farmers and labor, not only in the present moment, why labor and why unions were important to the farming way of life, essentially, but also it's their historical connection here in the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, I believe the speech actually took place on the day of the Tractorcade, which was this incredible outpouring of solidarity from farming families who brought in from all over the state their threshers and manure spreaders and tractors and other large farming equipment and paraded or tractorcaded around the Capitol in support of labor. And Tony Schultz stated, and again, this is also available on YouTube. It's incredibly powerful. But I believe what he said, or what I remember him saying, is, you know, for these farming communities who have some, in some cases, a school might be one of the only things that those communities still have, because so many people have moved. You know, there have been tremendous migrations of population from these rural areas, these rural communities, to larger cities or out of the state, and that those farming communities really very much appreciate the hard work their teachers do, because those teachers provide their children with the education they need to succeed. And there was worry, and there probably is still worry about, if you cannot provide people with a decent wage or protection, and from a hostile working environment, if you can't provide them with benefits, then who is actually going to take the job of being a teacher, and how those working conditions will then affect learning conditions? That was one of the protest mantras from the teachers who participated in those weeks of demonstration. My working conditions are your child's learning conditions. And I think that that's a perfect representation of what the connection between teachers and teachers' unions to farming communities were. They understood the import of that. I think Tony was trying to explain the import of that connection, and why farmers stood, at least this was one example of the reason why farmers were standing beside teachers who are unionized workers, and how the farming communities understood their value and the value of the union, in not only for the lives of the teachers, but also for the lives of the students. That's the speech I will most remember.
Okay. You initially were not able to speak to the Joint Finance Committee, but you were able to eventually share your thoughts.
Yes, I was. I was not coherent, nor was I eloquent at the time. I actually cried a lot because I was angry and sad, and it was early in the morning after sleeping not at all the previous evening, because I had been up waiting to give testimony. I don't actually even remember what I said, but I know that after I had given my testimony, a woman who I was sitting next to gave me Kleenex, and as like, a, you know, again, as a sign of support and solidarity, she had laid some Kleenex on my chair, and she just gave me a smile and shook her head and you know, in a way said she, you know, it was like a, it was an acknowledgement of understanding about how momentous this was.
What were your strongest memories of the protests generally?
I What were my well, I mean, there's so many. I don't know. The size of the protest was clearly something that shocked me and inspired me. The variety of the people who were present, seeing a sea of red because people were wearing red to the protests is going to be a visual that I'll never forget. And also the cacophony within the Capitol itself was indescribable, really. Marble echoes in a very magnificent sort of way. So imagining people with noisemakers, with their own voices, with the firefighters, bagpipe menagerie or their bagpipe band, and the forward marching band, and people had drums and all sorts of things. So, you know, that will forever be a part of that experience, as will all of the chants that we learned and people created. You know, this is a moment, these protests, they created this space for tremendous creativity and generosity amongst the people who participated. So creativity in terms of what people said on all of the protest signage was really spectacular, because people are so witty about with their criticisms, and some of them were just wonderful because they were so straightforward. You know, I remember one, there are so many, but I remember one saying, "Now you've pissed off my grandma," or something like that. "Now you've got grandma angry," you know, it held by a small child, which was really amusing. Or 2, 4, 6, 8, Walker sucks. Like, that was not, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was just, there was, you know, people were finding ways to be, I guess, trying to provide a little levity while also really satirizing what was going on, and providing a very critical analysis. As far as, so that was, you know, it was inspiring in a very real way. The other thing about generosity that I'm never going to forget, people, you know, in times like, I've attended some other protests. The largest one I had ever attended was before I got to UW-Madison. It was when the U.S. entered the war with Iraq in March of, I want to say, 2004. And I had attended, and it was huge. It was in New York City, so there were hundreds of thousands of people stretched for miles. But I remember, and it was also, these protests are always on cold days, apparently. But I remember marching along by myself and people just offering food and drink to me. Like, grandma's giving me cookies. "Do you want a cookie, honey?" "No, I'm okay, thanks." And so it was similar. People here, you know, while you were protesting, you know, folks would share what they had with you. We received at the TIA a number of food donations and donations in kind. So we created a food table within the rotunda itself, where we placed food and then had gigantic food table outside of 300 Northeast, where people could, I can't remember the number exactly. Yeah, okay. Where people could come and get something to eat if they wanted. But there were donations of folks, I don't know who started it or what, but there was a pizza place down just off of the Capitol called Ian's Pizza. And when the protesting first began, people who were witnessing what was happening in Wisconsin called up Ian's and had pizzas delivered so that the protesters could eat something. And I swear to God, there were hundreds of pizzas delivered over those weeks from people within Madison, within Wisconsin, across the United States, and from around the world. There were pizzas donated from Egypt, from South America. And Egypt, again, having just witnessed, the ouster, the resignation of Hosni Mubarak that, 1 week before on the 11th of February, and having witnessed that sort of revolution, if you could call it that, at least it was a hopeful moment as the Arab Spring was unfolding, and then witnessing it, witnessing a popular response to something that was viewed as illegitimate by people here in Wisconsin, was striking. While we were protesting, as you were outside in the cold, people would offer you hand warmers. I remember distributing hand warmers from folks who had given them to me to hand out to other people. Oh, are you in the TIA? Would you please take these? Or we had a number of things given by the Willie Street Co-op. Folks were calling them, giving them money so that they could send fruits and vegetables our way, because pizza is great, but it can get tiresome after a time. And I was really happy to see a vegetable after, I think, 3 or 4 days of nothing but pizza or a granola bar. One member had some friends back east who had a blog, a blog about politics, and they raised from their membership or their readership, I want to say over $15,000 for what we were doing as part of those donations were made to Defend Wisconsin, which was a website that the TIA had established at the outset of the occupation and the uprising. We specifically asked, in a way, we were soliciting donations because we didn't know how long we would be able to maintain the level of mobilization if we didn't have the food to give protesters or water. And some of there was a food table erected outside too, so folks who wanted to remain outside marching with the other, tens of thousands, 100,000 people wouldn't have to go inside the Capitol to get something. They could just, the food table was erected in different spots at different times. Other unions provided lots of resources as well. I think that was the import of big labor there in that respect, that they were able to mobilize lots of resources for the protesters, many of which, I think weren't part of unions at all, but were concerned members of the community, concerned students. And they had no union connection whatsoever, but it was, some of the unions did donate water and food and, I can't remember, it might have been, I think it was the building trades. They, for a solid week, they grilled bratwurst. And so we had brats for like a solid week that protesters could just go by and pick up a bratwurst. It was amazing. That's something that I will never forget. And just the size of the crowd was outstanding. Tractorcade was awesome too. And all of, the show of solidarity was, this was the biggest political protest I think I've ever seen. Nothing that I've ever seen before. Again, the New York protest was larger just by virtue of the fact that we were in New York City, but this was the largest protest I had ever been involved in from the very beginning, and saw it grow into something that was about so much more than just collective bargaining rights. It became, I believe that a lot of the people that participated were interested in the various negative repercussions of what the budget repair bill would visit upon them and the people they cared about, as well as what people then saw in a way as an omen of things to come in terms of what the budget would likely look like given the budget repair bill, and that it could not be anything good. And then the final thing I'll share, because you've been so patient listening to me, is that so our relationships with inside the Capitol, you know, we were constantly aware of the ways in which we were negotiating space, and negotiating space, I mean, with the Capitol Police and the state troopers and others. And it was by and large incredibly respectful, and that was because there was lots of communication going on, as well as an understanding about, I think, an acknowledgement that they had a job to do whether or not they wanted to or not, meaning whether or not they agreed with the dictates of Scott Walker and his supporters or not. And I think there was an understanding on the part of the police and the state patrol that we too had a purpose and a reason for being there. And so I think that was handled in an incredibly positive way. But in, you know, it was in speaking with those, it was likely a very conscious decision to speak to the police and remind them, remind state patrol officers that you were a human being, that you weren't an enemy. And so we were all very aware of treating one another with respect and with and kindness. And I remember one of the last nights I was in the Capitol, I spoke to a police officer who was retired from Waterford or Watertown, I can't remember which, but he had volunteered to come up and serve to, I guess, guard the Capitol or observe. And I struck up a conversation with this man, and I thanked him for, you know, treating us with respect. And I asked him, you know, what he thought of this. And he, you know, I guess I was actually taken aback by his response. He said, "Oh, I think this is great. You know, before I came up here, my family and my friends had thought that it would be a bad idea, and they very much discouraged me, and they thought I would get hurt and it would be violent, and they did not want me to come up here. And they've called me since I've been up here." They were only serving 2 or 3 day shifts, I want to say. And he received calls from his family, and he said that they could hear the noise in the background, and so they were very, very worried. And he stopped to explain to them that it's not because it was violent. It was because people were having a good time, and people were smiling and cheering and chanting and clapping and dancing. And that was the noise they were hearing, not because it was some sort of riot going on. That people had been incredibly respectful of him, had been kind, had offered him food and drink, which is, of course, what we did. And that it was not at all what these folks had feared it might be. And in talking with a variety of, you made kind of fast friends in this space, because in a way you were all there for the same purpose. You discovered that many folks, and I would say I would include myself in this, had never had the opportunity to participate in something like this before, because we haven't seen anything like this since, the civil rights era, since the anti-war movement, since the feminist movement, in terms of large, really large mobilizations of people responding to political decisions that went beyond just casting a vote. And folks had forgotten or had never experienced this before, had never had an opportunity to understand that this was yet another way that they could, you know, either show their approval or disapproval, dissent, if you will. And I think that that was mind-blowing to a lot of people, and invigorating in a very positive way. And I think that that goes for anybody, for all age groups who are involved.
Do you believe that your experience of the protest was accurately represented in the media?
Well, clearly, I mean, it depends on what media outlet you're watching, right? So Fox News, you know, there were signs like Fox News will lie about this because that's what Fox News does. And the reason I say that is because Fox News used stock footage of another protest somewhere that had palm trees, and they, where there was a scuffle or a violent encounter between apparently union protesters and supporters of some kind. I don't even remember the context of the footage, but they claimed that that footage was from Wisconsin, and everybody who saw the footage understood that there aren't palm trees in Madison, Wisconsin. So Fox News had clearly inaccurately reported what was happening here. I think that some of the coverage that we received on MSNBC was largely accurate. You know, they are pundits just the same. You know, Ed Schultz is a pundit just like Bill O'Reilly is, I suppose. But at least their coverage was definitely some of the best we ever received in terms of something more than a 30-second clip, and endeavored to understand why we were there. The coverage in more alternative outlets was, I think, the best. And this, so The Nation, for example, if you consider The Nation an alternative publication, which I suppose I do in the sense that it doesn't have, I would say it probably doesn't have the same readership as The Times or something like that, and The Progressive magazine. We also got a number of the coverage reflected in a variety of blogs, and other things, and other outlets like that were incredibly important, and social media was of the utmost importance during the occupation. With social media, we were able to mobilize people quickly. With social media, we were able to tell the story as it was happening, without specific filters. And I think it would have looked completely different if we did not have those outlets. So, you know, unfortunately, I think coverage in the media was actually truncated, at least nationally. We didn't get a lot of national coverage, as far as I know. Again, my memory of our media coverage on the national level is spotty because I wasn't anywhere near a television, so I was in the Capitol all of the time. And when I wasn't in the Capitol, I was asleep, or taking a shower at home. But I know that national coverage was diverted from what was going on here in Wisconsin to cover the Fukushima nuclear reactor meltdown in Japan. I believe that happened either the second or third week inside the during the uprising. And so I believe that that national disaster, you know, rightfully captured the world's attention, much like Wisconsin captured the world's attention for a moment. But we definitely were in that sort of international spotlight for a short period of time.
Okay. Could you say a little bit more about what types of social media you were relying on?
Mm-hmm. Well, we relied very much on Facebook and Twitter. I believe those were the top two social media outlets we used at a time. I remember actually heading into the Capitol where I received a text message from the co-president telling me that we had trended to number one on Twitter. And that was, you know, big news. I still to this day don't necessarily understand what that means. If that means that, like, everybody was following what was happening in the occupation and in the uprising, or if there just so happened to be so and so many tweets about that. I don't know, but I remember thinking that was a big deal. I think also blogs. You know, a variety of folks had blogs, either students who were blogging about what was going on, as well as independent media outlets that I would say are more or less like perhaps a blog format, in the sense that they're not an online newspaper, for example, but do feature I don't want to say freelance content, but don't necessarily have staff, but are publish accounts from readers and others. Facebook and Twitter were the main two.
Great. How did you budget your time during the protests?
I didn't budget my time. No, I didn't budget my time.
Okay.
I was there most of the time, and when I wasn't there, I was thinking about being there or doing something that would support what was going on there. So it's not as though I was there 100% of the time. I wasn't. But I feel as though most of my responsibilities, personal and professional, or personal and academic, were placed on the back burner during that time.
How did your experience of the protests, if it did, shape your experiences now in this current year, perhaps as a graduate student or as a member of the TAA?
I don't know that it changed anything. I believe that being in a labor union was just as important then as it is now. It's even more important now because of the attack on public sector unions, because of the attack on private sector unions. I think, again, seeing that response and seeing the ways in which a variety of people were able to understand an issue within a very short period of time, and to understand, again, as I've said before, that there's so much more to politics than just voting. I think that is incredibly important as a lesson, and I hope people really take that home and actually really reflect upon it. I feel as though for me, as an activist, I guess, or a union member, or both, I believe direct action and protest in those ways are incredibly important as tools when one sees injustice or needs to respond to what one sees in the electoral political arena. I don't think based on you know, the history of unions, for example, that either party, whether it be Republicans or Democrats, really has is in the corner of labor, despite claims to the contrary. And so I think that we need to reflect on, we as a movement or unionists need to reflect on how we move forward, and think about the ways in which we respond to this new world that we find ourselves in. I'm incredibly humbled by what happened last year and thankful that I was able to participate in something like that. I don't think that it changed, you know, again, it only reinforces why I'm in a union, why I think unions are important. That unions are one of the only ways in the United States today where people can, that serve as a, where folks can unite under a collective voice and a collective mission and can propel that forward or propel those messages forward, that agenda forward, particularly in light of the money that corporate interests and the resources that they have that we must fight against. I think that it's only in coming together and in recognizing common purpose, common cause, common interests, that working people are going to be able to, you know, fight for the things they want. And I think that, you know, again, what happened last year is a reminder to unionists, but also hopefully was illustrative to non-unionists or people who had either thought negatively of unions or had never belonged to a union, that this is a means by which regular people, working people, people who don't have corporate billions can affect change, or at least can have can at least engage in the debate about whatever issue is on the table, because you cannot do it alone. You can't. It's very difficult to do it as a single person. You have to do it collectively, and I think that's what we saw in the uprising, that it was united under a common cause, with a common set of demands and complaints, that people came together to fight back against something that they saw as illegitimate and immoral.
Great. To the extent that you would wish to do so, could you tell us about your final plans, future plans, perhaps academically or in terms of your relationship with the TAA?
God, my final plans in terms of my academic career are nebulous at best to me. Currently, I'm still planning on continuing my pursuit of a PhD. However, this experience has led me to reflect on whether or not being involved in the labor movement in a professional capacity might be also something that would satisfy the need to do something worthwhile for my community, or to satisfy my desire to effect positive social change, or to fight inequality. So I've been giving some thought about that, as I'm still going to remain a TAA member. Being the co-president of the TAA is very rewarding, but also very time consuming. And so I don't know if I will run for the co-presidency again come springtime or not. I wouldn't completely rule it out, given that other folks have talked to me about it and would like me to continue. I think it's difficult to be a quote-unquote leader. So I don't know what I will do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there any additional comments or thoughts you wish to share?
Yes, yeah. I did forget one thing, or what I would like to mention, which I think some folks have addressed, and maybe in these interviews, but also in reflections that I've read elsewhere. I think that what we saw in Wisconsin, whether acknowledged or not by Occupy Wall Street, very much influenced what we saw there. And its outgrowth to other cities and communities across the United States and elsewhere. I remember specifically that meeting students from CUNY who had driven all the way out from New York to come and witness what was happening here. And they ended up, those students from CUNY, ended up being very active in the Occupy Wall Street movement. The thing, you know, they had, much like here in the occupation, where we, and we, I mean, not the TAA, but participants in the occupation, you know, one undergraduate, Harriet, she established the information station so that people could understand what was going on. There was, you know, the food tables, there was a medic station, there was childcare, there was a lending library. These things happened because participants saw a need for them and they took action, which was, you know, incredibly important. I don't think that, I think that labor, big labor particularly, has an interest to claim that what happened in those weeks in February and March were due to their planning or their involvement. And while they definitely supported what happened, I think that it was actually more a spontaneous bottom-up process. And these institutions that were created were a reflection of that. And those institutions were later established at OWS. And so I, you know, maybe given that I've never participated in anything like this before, maybe these are just standard things that one has, but I found it really interesting that they had similar or identical institutions that they erected to provide people the support they needed. I also just want to say too that some of the other things that the TAA did that I think was, again, a recognition that we were all sharing one space. You know, someone created the Trash Brigade, where members went around and picked up trash outside and inside the Capitol with an understanding that we all shared this space. This was something that our community owned, that we all had a right to it, and so it was all in our interest to take care of it. And we weren't destroying public property. We actually were very, very sensitive to that. Used painter's tape to hang up signs so that we wouldn't scuff the walls. We made sure that people put trash away, and when they didn't, you know, every day people went outside to pick up garbage. There were people who volunteered to marshal every day outside to make sure there weren't scuffles or anything between anti-walker and pro-walker individuals, though the pro-walker individuals were few and far between, though they attempted to, you know, mount a tea party a Tea Party defense or something. It was rather pathetic, and everybody ignored them anyway. But these were things that were thought about not in the none of us in the TAA, and I don't think anyone period set out with a plan. It was something that evolved spontaneously, organically, and people stepped up where they saw there was a need, and that's how it grew, and that's how I think so many people took ownership of the uprising and of the occupation, because it was everyone's, and we all had a stake in it, and we had a stake in it because, you know, there were spaces where people could feel that they were actively participating and not just being dictated to. I hated it, actually, when big labor came in and tried to dictate to us what we were supposed to do. Because we weren't... Where were they on those first days? They weren't there. It was the rank and file leading the way, and big labor and big labor leaders following. And I think that there were tensions there, too, between big labor and labor leaders who weren't spending the night in the Capitol, who weren't there with their own boots on the ground, and their attempts to quote-unquote manage the occupation and the uprising with the people who were there and had been spending all of their time there but weren't from any sort of organization and so therefore didn't have those specific resources. But that does not mean that what they were doing was not valuable and that they didn't have particular insights. And so there was a tension between those official bodies and those of just concerned community members. But those folks who weren't affiliated with unions were incredibly important and gave so much to the occupation and how it evolved. And they deserve as much credit, if not more, than the big labor unions who, you know, for good or for ill, are oftentimes credited, I think, with the success and viability of the occupation, whereas the people who are participating that really are responsible. And I think it's because, on the ground anyway, people tried to do their best to make sure that, again, they respected one another and understood what each person brought to the table. And I don't know necessarily that big labor anyway did a good job of communicating that to folks that weren't affiliated with it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
All right. I am Megan Filater.
I'm Adrienne Padgick.
And we're just adding a short note to her interview.
Yes. I mentioned to Megan that I wanted to add just one sort of comment or reflection on the gender dynamics within at least within the TAA and within the occupation, I felt. What struck me as, I guess, a sociologist in training and as a union activist and union member and graduate student, this notion that we are surrounded by people who at least should have some familiarity with misogyny and chauvinism, and paternalistic behavior and an understanding that that is actually unacceptable. However, as a participant and as a woman in the uprising and the occupation of the Capitol and what that entailed, myself and a variety of other women definitely felt that there was an odd that the relationships between men and women were incredibly gendered, meaning that a number of us women felt as though we were condescended to, that we didn't understand what we were talking about, that men didn't respect women, that women were expected to clean up after the men, that women were responsible for the food table, that women couldn't, there wasn't space for the female participants to offer reflections or tactical suggestions, that essentially we were second-class citizens, or lesser participants. And so a number of us got together and had a drink outside of the Capitol, and I called it, it was very tongue-in-cheek, but I called it, let's have a women's auxiliary meeting. The women's auxiliary being something that happened in, the Flint sit-down strikes. And probably in union history generally, there was always a women's component or a division. But it was a number of us who had participated in those days at the Capitol, probably midway through, where it was a safe space for us to talk about our experiences and to discover that we weren't crazy, that in fact we were being treated in an equitable way, that it wasn't, and it didn't just happen to me, or it didn't just happen to Lenora, it happened to all of us in different situations, where the men participating treated us in a way like little girls, or as servants, or as potential dates, rather than as equals. And it was a very patriarchal setting. And so it was shocking because, so many of these men who I interact with on an everyday would claim themselves to be feminists, would claim themselves to be radicals, and therefore would claim to have a sense of egalitarian principles or would operate as such, and they didn't realize, because they failed to reflect on their own behavior, the ways in which they were treating us in a rather chauvinistic manner. One of the men who did acknowledge this was, in fact, someone from our sister union, MGAA, out of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And he pointed out to me, he thanked me for doing all of, he had been upset about something and I was willing to talk to him about it. And he thanked me afterwards for doing emotion work with him. And he said that none of the men had been willing to acknowledge his feelings, to apologize for the way in which he had been treated, because he had felt that he had also been treated as a lesser contributor, because he wasn't a TAA member, but a member of the Milwaukee Graduate Assistant Association, and that he wasn't being given the respect that he deserved, or was not being acknowledged. And I told him, I of course apologized to him and told him that, I appreciated that he was there, and that many of us did understand what they were contributing, and felt, was clearly a sense of solidarity with him and with them. And so he thanked me about that and said that, he did not feel that way with a lot of the men in the TAA, at least in his interactions with them. So that struck me, and it struck me that the women, the 15 to 20 or so women who came to this women's auxiliary meeting felt the same way, and that it was real. And that's something that the labor movement still needs to work on, even amongst, folks who are, in a way should know better, because they've taken classes where they should know better, and they don't. And it was really interesting.
Is this an issue that you or perhaps the other women who went to this meeting were able to give some type of pushback or feedback on to the TA membership or individual men at any point? Or is this just something that...
I'm sure that some of us brought it up individually, but not not in any sort of formal way. It all depended on the relationships with which we previously had with these men. In some cases, yes, I did. One person, when I made mention of how I felt he was treating me and others, became very upset because he had not realized that he was doing that, and so was saddened by that. He ultimately, you know, he was happy to hear it, though he became very upset, and I became upset upon his being a, you know, I didn't want him to feel poorly about it. I just wanted him to say, to see how other people might feel in being treated in this manner. So he was, so he responded but I think, you know, the vast majority of other men, I don't even know if they would have been able to understand, you know, understand the criticism or understand the point we were making. You would have to, you know, that would be something to ask the other women, like Lenora. You could ask Lenora about it.
Sure, and then also, of course, making it the job of women to be giving that type of feedback.
Right, just yeah, to right.
Come
yeah.
about some of the issues.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Yeah, so it was, in a way, it was kind of like, why bother?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do we expect in return?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. A lot of yeah, yeah. Okay.